back. WNST, Towson Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We got a full house today.
Oh, man.
Don Moeller is back on the set. He is staying 6 feet away from me. Most importantly, we are at State Fair. It's all brought to you by our friends at the Maryland Lottery. We're letting ourselves play. I've got some scratch-offs right here. We got a new scratch-off game. It is the $10,000 Show Me game. We're giving them away today out here at State Fair. And it's also brought to you, of course, by our friends at Window Nation. I wore this when I had Mayor Scott on 2 weeks ago. Then the next, it looked like I was dealing cards. I looked like Jack Lemmon in like The Odd Couple or something like that. So, and also our dear friends at Goodwill. We had Lisa Rosiniak on this week, as well as Business Volunteers MD and Julie Kernan. You can find all that out at BaltimorePositive.com. You know, this guy is a regular on Baltimore Positive, and much like his companion and colleague Max Weiss, we haven't been able to sit together.
We usually see him through a screen, man.
Like, I didn't even, like, you're so tanned, Ron Cassie, that it looks like you were in Italy or the south of France, not in Ireland. The sun doesn't shine in Ireland. I was there for 6 hours last month.
I am back from vacation in Ireland. I did a lot of biking in Ireland, and it's funny. I was telling people while I was there, too, like text messaging. I would look at my app, my phone, and it would just be like rain for like 6 days straight. You know, you do that forecast. And then I'd look at it like an hour and a half later, and it would be sun for 6 days straight. And then, you know, just would flip-flop back and forth. It's really, even hourly, it's just amazing. It rained every day, but it never rained. You know, I don't know how else to put it.
How long were you in Ireland?
Oh, close to 4 weeks.
I think you guys passed in the airport, didn't you? You were on your way to Amsterdam.
No, I was there when he was in Ireland.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it is amazing on the travel front. And, Don, you're about to do some traveling. I'm literally looking out of the corner of my eye. Wimbledon's on here at State Fair. We're at State Fair in Catonsville. Home, as I like to call it. I don't know if I'm going to room for a crab cake today on the Maryland Crab Cake Tour.
And
chicken and waffles.
Cracker Jack intern Chloe Ennis wiped out some French fries and some twisted turkey.
They even have a gluten-free bun here.
By the way, dude. You have never been this organized. So whatever Chloe Ennis is bringing to the show, it's well worth it.
Well, it's a good thing I have an intern pipeline over here in Catonsville coming out of South Carolina. But Leonard Raskin's at Wimbledon. I spent a week in Germany and Amsterdam. You've been in Ireland. We're moving around again. And the world's moving around. And if you spent any time in a Dublin airport that you did, you know, I spent time in the Amsterdam airport getting around.
Hey man,
Cologne airport.
I just had the trip from hell trying to get back from Milwaukee,
Wisconsin.
You have
your voice back. We should say that the former county executive and my high school guidance counselor, finally you contracted COVID, right?
After 2.5 years, it finally hunted me down. It did.
And Sounds like it kicked your ass. You don't sound good, dude.
I feel fine. I'm way past shedding and all of that. But it was nasty. And being in the airport for 20-some hours trying to get home.
Golfing. This is why I don't golf. No offense, Classic 5. Tom, I'm going to have you on Friday. You know that. But you know, we're traveling. You know, we're moving around, right? And I guess that's all part of people like us love to do that. It's such a enrichment of our lives, even when you're stuck in a Milwaukee
airport. Going to ask both of you that because Ron was posting amazing pictures and sharing amazing stuff, and you were doing the same. So I had Ron in Ireland. I had you in Amsterdam. I was living vicariously through both of you. Ron, Nestor talks about that a lot. What is it about travel that appeals to you? What do you like about it?
So much. You know, this was a trip. I'll just get to touch on the COVID a bit. I was going to visit where... I went to England with my daughter, where my mother's parents are both born, raised, and immigrated from in their 20s. And my father's side of the family, his mother was Irish. And the second half of that trip, I was going to go to Dublin and visit where my great-great-grandfather...
So you were doing roots. It was a roots trip.
Absolutely. I was going my great-great-grandfather had immigrated from Dublin during the Great Famine. I had one day in Dublin. This is 2 years ago. I was flying from London to Dublin, right?
That's 10 minutes.
10 minutes. CNN alert when we touched down. Got to head back to the U.S. I had one day in Dublin. So
wow.
Was that pre-COVID?
Like it was when COVID hit. 13th. That was like March 13th.
March 13th.
I'm in the plane. I hit that. And I'm like, I get one day.
I'm sitting with Ted Venatoulis doing chicken and waffles.
I was supposed to be there for St. Patrick's Day. So in 2020. So I ended up going back for, I ended up with Memorial Day weekend and 3 weeks vacation time. I took 4 weeks to go. And I did work over there. But, you know, partly the nice thing is, like, for me, it's really, when I travel, it's best when it's not just as a tourist or a stop. It's kind of integrated, you know, into things I enjoy, things that I'm excited about doing and learning. And so part of it was the family history. I went to where my great-grandfather was baptized, the ruins of that church in Dublin. I found a couple, like Baltimore County, Texas, Maryland, kind of the core.
Did you go to Dundalk?
Or I didn't go to Dundalk. I didn't go to Baltimore, but...
How do you go to Dublin and not go to Dundalk?
But I found an interesting story about famine immigrants from Ireland who founded Texas, Maryland. Right now, it's just a part of Cockeysville. It doesn't exist anymore.
That's right. Who
pulled all the quarry out? Our stoops, Washington Monument, St. Patrick's. I'm riding my bike from Dublin to Galway, and there's these little monuments, these bronze shoes, memorials to immigrate there to memorialize their walk from the land that they were pushed off of, literally by English landlords in 1843. They walked the canal all the way to Dublin, hoping to get a ship to Liverpool to the U.S. And, you know, these were called coffin ships. People would die of starvation during the Great Famine on the way to Baltimore. But in Texas, Maryland, they arrive 1843. The NCR railroad's just been built. Right. The quarries just opened up. And these quarries, they became known as the Quarry Irish. And some of these folks are buried at St. Joseph's Parish Church.
So Texas, Maryland was founded by Irish.
By Irish, because the name comes from, it ceased to be Texas, Maryland kind of about 1950. They lost their post office. But it was named Texas, Maryland because even earlier Irish immigrants had actually joined the U.S. Army to fight in the Spanish or the Mexican-American War. And when they were known as like the Green Army in literally fighting in Texas against the Mexican army. And so they came back in honor of that service. They named it Texas, Maryland. That's the story, at least, as best as we could discern.
All right. Well, the historian, Ron Cassie, Baltimore Magazine.
So the travel's a lot of fun because, you know, you learn so much along the way, as well as, for me, as well as getting to, you know, disassociate yourself from where you're all entangled in your day-to-day life.
It's my thing. And the journey's never like, I went to see the Rolling Stones.
Yeah.
And Mick got COVID 2 hours before the show, and there was no show, right? Oh. That was not the purpose of being there. The purpose was the man who saved my wife's life lives in Germany, and we wanted to spend time with him.
Yeah.
So it's fine, but it's even funnier when things go wrong, when you get trapped in the Ireland airport, and Niels has to drive from Germany over to Amsterdam to get you. Otherwise, you're not going to wind up in Germany until 2 in the morning on the train. So, like, all of these... The things that go wrong, the mishaps. He's texting me. Now, you were sick, but he's bitching. He's in the airport. And it's in all this. I said, get a book. You find a comfortable seat. Write your book. Write a blog. Take a nap. Get a massage. Get your feet rubbed. Do something. There's a million things you could do. Not in the Milwaukee airport. Get some cheese.
To build on your point, you can't experience the kindness of strangers, right? Like, unless you get lost, unless you get into some trouble while you're traveling.
Well,
that's what comes from, right?
My thing with Dundalk, Ireland was we went over to see U2 in Dublin, and of course, I want to do that. So we see U2 in Croke Park. My wife had was just getting better, and we were scouting England for the Wembley trip. So it was in 17, and we went over, and I'm like, I know there's a Dundalk, Ireland. I mean, I'm not stupid. Right. I wonder where it is. I looked it up. It's from here to Westminster. You know what I mean? It's 40 minutes, kind of, sort of, on a road, wrong side of the road, wrong side of the car, the whole deal. And I'm like, I'm going to go there. And I Googled it to find out a little bit about it. It was a Sunday roast, very proper in Ireland. And I found an Irish tavern online. It was called McGo's. And I'm like, my father's name was McGurgan. And I'm like, close enough, so we'll go there. We went there. You ask why I travel? Because you have an experience you talk about the rest of your life.
Well,
I'll probably never go back to Dundalk, Ireland, but I sat at that bar and met everybody. I met a man who was so nice to us. He was so impressed we were from the Dundalk, Maryland, because he had heard about it, that he took my address and sent me a box of Dundalk stuff. The Dundalk shirt that I usually wear to the Heritage Fair isn't from Dundalk, Maryland. It's this guy that sent me a shirt from Ireland that said, it's a Dundalk thing. You wouldn't understand.
That's from there you go. See, that's it. But you always say, before we switch to some of the things that Ron's been writing about, I always give you credit for this concept, and I want to see if Ron agrees, particularly as a writer. You said to me, I don't know, Nestor, maybe 10 years ago, you said...
I don't even know what I said. You said, this is the best part.
I got popcorn, too. You said, I learn an awful lot about someone when I meet a new person, and we get talking, and I say to them, do you have a passport?
Oh, Chloe.
Why, she's heard that? You said that?
The thing I told her, Chloe's my intern, and you want to give some a plug to Chloe and her dad.
The Ennis family, one of the great families, right, in Baltimore and Southern Maryland, and they've been around forever, and dear friends of mine. But I'm just watching, as I said earlier, Chloe bring some order to this ship, which is good. But what are you saying about
Chloe
passports?
And I spent an inordinate amount of time together the last month or two since she's been back. And the thing I said to her, forget everything else you'll learn this summer, your credits, your sports marketing, this, that. You're getting a passport.
Right.
I've told her she's getting a passport. And that's going to be my parting gift to you, that every time you don't get them stamped anymore. It sucks. They don't stamp you the way they used to.
But it does speak. You know? Do you agree with that premise, Ryman? It does speak to some part of intellectual. Now, we're assuming, we recognize that the three of us are fortunate in the sense that at this point in our lives,
blessed,
we do have the resources to be able to go and experience some of these things. So there are folks who would like to that couldn't.
But I'm saying it's worth it when you do. It's worth it when you do.
We've all known people, I certainly have, who have said to me, I'm not going anywhere. I mean, I've known people who say that.
Lots
to me. I'm not going anywhere. I have no interest. And speaks volumes, I think, about curiosity. Right, Ryan?
Yeah, and I think, you know, I wish I had traveled more when I was young. Reverend Alvin Hathaway, you know, rehabbing the Thurgood Marshall Elementary School, told me a story that when he was a young man and he had been fired from a job or two, and he was still in his early 20s, one of his mentors told him Greyhound was offering this, like, all-inclusive, like, for $50, you can ride on the bus all across
summer.
The country, back and forth, it's all the way around.
It's just a summer rail pass, summer pass.
It was back, like in the 70s, right?
Oh,
so he did the whole thing. So here's a, you know, young black man from West Baltimore, and he's going to Notre Dame, Indiana, Minneapolis. He's going to San Francisco. He's coming.
We got to talk to him about that when he
goes all the way down to Bakersfield, California. Coming, he said, you know, there's a part of where you're on a road in the Southwest, I guess, where one side of the street is Tennessee, and I think one part is Missouri, but all parts of the country had to see. And it was the context and the perspective and the distance from his own life and his own situation, you know, and I think that's really great if you can do that when you're young.
There's something wonderful about being a stranger. I mean that when I'm walking the streets of Amsterdam at 3 a.m., getting, a delicious, street sandwich, a keto, or a shawarma out on the street, and I'm just walking around Amsterdam, and it's safe, and it's different.
Yeah.
And I use every minute when I travel. When I travel, I don't sleep. I don't sleep much. I sleep a little bit, but I'm amped wherever I am to see and experience as much as I can.
Well, the last travel story, and we then have
we're gonna
move
travel back
on
to West Baltimore, do the Wire.
We're gonna move on to the Wire, and it's 20-year anniversary. The last travel story goes to what you're talking about, the joy of the unexpected per se. We were traveling through France, up and down the countryside, and in lots of places in France, they speak English. Now, my wife happens to be pretty fluent in French, having been a French teacher, so we're good either way. But we ended up in this little village, and when I say little village, I mean little village, a couple of homes, and yet there was this sort of bakery delicatessen, for what I would call it. They wouldn't call it a delicatessen, sandwich shop. And we walked in, and this gentleman out of Central Casting was behind the counter. I mean, it looked like something out of a Disney film that you would think would be the main cook in this little place. And no one spoke a lick of English in this little place. And we thought, man, we could be in trouble now. But luckily, my wife was there. And she says, you could tell the gentleman was a little nervous because he knew we were Americans and probably couldn't speak. And my wife something, and I can't replicate it, but one of the words was jambon, you know, the sandwich, jambon. And
that's a ham sandwich.
Basically, see, yeah, exactly.
That's a ham sandwich.
Exactly. And she said something, do you have any jambon? Well, his face lit up. He reached under the counter, picked up a huge loaf of bread and some cheese, and he went, jambon! And he was just thrilled. And from that moment on, turns out, this is what you talk about, the unexpected pleasures, there are plaques. And you begin to notice all over this little shop that's no bigger than really where we're sitting, of him with presidents. And I'm going, wait a minute, what's happening? And then grand prize winner. He was the grand prize winner in all of France for the best foie gras in all of France. And they flew him to the White House periodically to serve foie gras, this guy in this little place that we stumbled into because we said, we've got to get something.
How was the jambon?
To eat. The jambon was incredible.
C'est bon.
For people who don't know, it's just nothing more than a thin little slice of ham, a thin little slice of cheese, and some butter on bread. Nothing else. And it sounds ridiculous. Spectacular.
Simple things in life,
spectacular.
Right? Like Irish food.
Well,
right?
let's talk, and I'm kicking myself, and Nestor then can't make fun of me. I'm sorry, Max Weiss. I normally come prepared for these Baltimore segments with my printed copy because I love the subscription to Baltimore Magazine, and it's sitting at home on my desk.
You're waving Ron Cassidy.
I'm giving him the real thing today. But
right.
the cover of this, Nestor, was just a spectacular cover of the 20th anniversary story that Ron did of The Wire because it was sort of cartoon characters.
Well, I can't wait to talk
about
this.
There it is.
The audacity of despair. And everybody should go check it out. Everybody knows Ron Cassidy from Baltimore Magazine. So we had Simon on. We've had Zorzi. We had people on. When I had Simon on, I said to him what I'm going to say to you, which is, I've never seen The Wire. And everybody's like, oh, how? Simon's like, good, you don't need to. You know, I really do want to watch it.
The way he put it was, I'm not going to beg you.
Right.
That's the Wire.
So, you know, it's 70 hours-ish, right? I mean, of the investment of time.
5 years.
I fully expect to watch it at some point in the next 2 or 3 years of my life. And I'll binge it when I have time. I'm building a business. I got football. I got things going on. Crab cake tours. But prepare me for that in some way as... You know, you've written about the history for people that have seen it, but prepare somebody like me for somebody that hasn't seen it and why I should give it 70 hours of my time. Because everybody says I should, that's why I'm going to. I mean, here it's the greatest thing that's ever been made. Not just a Baltimore thing, that's a worldwide thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'll answer that a little bit by talking about like the impetus for the story, you know? I mean, before I talked to David Simon, he was very generous with his time and thoughts. I mean, a couple hours at his home and office in Federal Hill. You know, I watched the whole 60-plus hours
recently
before doing this. I read Homicide, the book he wrote, which is, you know, 600,
right.
700 pages. I watched The Corner, which is what you should watch first. Watch The Corner in HBO. That won Emmy Awards, directed by Charles Dutton, you know, of Rock, right?
Rock, sure. Yeah.
Amazingly empathetic, compelling, holds up today, heart-wrenching. I mean, you'll shed a tear. I mean, it's really powerful. And that's really the spiritual predecessor kind of to The Wire.
So I talked to you about this because, you know, I could just dive in and buy the DVDs tonight. But
Watch The Corner first.
I've waited 20 years.
Corner's
it's
only
going to
be six
for
hours of
okay.
your time.
All right.
Watch that first. And because The Wire is 180 degrees from The Corner. You know, the Wire, the Corner goes into the tragedy of drug addiction, of poverty, of the drug war, because Charles Dutton, who grew up there, is directing this story, but also the way the book was written, and Simon and Ed Burns spent a year in the one corner in West Baltimore, Fayette and Monroe, observing everything. It tells that story organically from the people who are suffering up, right? The Wire tells it differently. It tells it from the point of view of McNulty really is, the one cop, is really the core protagonist in the story throughout all the seasons, right? A white cop. Now, it's told through multiple perspectives, and that's kind of the genius of all the novelists Simon brings into the room to write the thing. They're weaving this incredible
story. Well, I watched The Sopranos. You know, I love The Sopranos. I'm expecting it to be that freaking good.
In a different way, because The Sopranos is easier to follow because of, you know, it's the one lead character Tony Soprano, right, that you follow. James Gandolfini gives a performance of a lifetime through that whole thing. It's very compelling. It's a family drama, suburban New Jersey. Weirdly, from where I was born, by the way.
Wow.
Nutley, New Jersey, right next to where they live. Now I'm in Baltimore.
Bada bing.
Got
right.
myself a gun.
The Wire is 180 degrees, again, different from The Sopranos, but the quality, of as far as the art, right, is there for sure, as everybody says. So I think if you watch The Corner and you pivot to the, and you, then you go to The Wire, you can see the juxtaposition, really. The Wire, I looked at it for this story as a way to look journalistically at what was happening at that time, right? What was Simon, what were they reporting? What was happening in real time in Baltimore with the O'Malley administration, with the policies of mass incarceration? What were those numbers? I mean, there's a graph in our story about only, you know, they're arresting 100,000 people a year in Baltimore City during the O'Malley administration. Only 2.6% are for a violent crime. Only another 7% are for a property crime. I mean, the numbers are extraordinary when you get down
to it. It was weed and drugs and street deals, pretty much.
And it was a lot of loitering. It was a lot of, like, you know, taking a pee outside. It was a lot of, like, open can violation, trespass. I mean, made-up charges.
Or as my friend says, walking while black.
Right. There are all those things, right? So, and I wanted to interview, I talked to the guy who played the snot boogie corpse in the opening.
Well, wait a minute. Let you come back to that, because this is why Ron Cassie's in a class by himself. This is how the article basically begins. Three rivulets of blood illuminated by flashing blue lights seep from a body lying face down in the middle of a dark street. In the background, the wail of a squad car siren, the whirl of a helicopter, the howl of a neighborhood dog. A cop picks up a shell casing and places it into a plastic bag. Static voices blurt out from a police radio. Three school-age girls silently take in the scene from their row house stoop. On the steps of the vacant home on the same block, a white Baltimore homicide detective turns to the young black man seated next to him, bundled in a hoodie and winter coat, blankly staring at his just murdered buddy. So what's the boy? So your boy's name is what? Snot. You call a guy Snot? Snot Boogie. And you, with that, basically, you say the sort of the milieu of The Wire is built, right? I mean, that's, and then you're going to talk about Snot.
Yeah, that's a real anecdote that Simon heard when he was writing the homicide, the book, from a detective named Terry McLarney. Similar name, kind of, right, to McNulty, right?
Okay,
Jim McNulty.
Right, okay.
But I talked to DeJuan Prince, who basically played the Snot Boogie's chorus. He was like a teenager at the time, from West Baltimore, a young black guy. And I talked to Kamal Bostic Smith, a young actor, an activist community leader today in Philadelphia, who was talking to Jimmy McNulty in that story. So I talked to Trey Chaney, who's from PG County, who played Poot in the series, a really identifiable character. And I wanted to talk to some of these, you know, younger black guys who were teenagers at the time, or early 20s, about their experiences filming it, what they thought it depicted, and what they thought reflecting on it 20 years later, you know. And it was, you know, DeJuan Prince, who became a wardrobe and costume assistant as his career in television and film, said, you know, it looked different. I mean, at the time, he just thought, yeah, this is true. This stuff happens. You know, friends get murdered over dumb stuff like this, and there's not always a reason why. And 20 years later, he realizes, you know, the thing is, only some people pay that ultimate price. You know, politicians, lawyers, cops, their careers continue, their lives continue. And, you know, Simon, there's this line that Kamal Bostic Smith's character says about Jimmy McNulty about it, and it's said to Terry McLaurin in real life, you know, this is America, man. And that's what, you know, Simon is saying, you know, the audacity of despair, right? That's the playoff of, and that's his line, the playoff Obama's the audacity of hope,
sure.
Right? And these young guys experience it and contextualize it, and in a sense, making The Wire for them, I think, was a learning process, you know, and they're able to reflect. So we try to do that in the story, is to reflect what's changed since The Wire, what it depicted, as well as, you know, it's complicated in Baltimore. I mean, I'll just tie this briefly to Ireland. I met an Irish priest there when he learned I was from Baltimore, asked me about The Wire. this is just a couple
you
weeks.
You said it happens all the time.
Yeah, anywhere I go, people ask me about The Wire, but specifically in Europe.
Yeah.
It was a sincere...
Huge. In
Europe,
UK,
it's
right.
a huge
and
show.
And this was an Irish, 73-year-old Irish priest. New Baltimore because of The Wire. But
and that's what they think all of America is to some degree, or American cities.
Well,
right?
why was there the gun violence certainly, you know, in Texas and everything was getting a lot of attention, a lot of just, you know, incredulous reaction in the news media there, certainly. And it's
if you talk to anyone from another place,
yeah.
they say to you, what's wrong with you people? And that happened to me. And you said it would. It just it's matter of fact.
Yeah, always happens.
If you're American and they're not, they want to know why we live in a violent place.
What did this priest want to know about The Wire? Or did he just simply comment, oh, you're from Baltimore,
well,
The Wire?
Well, it had come up because of, it began a conversation about life in Dublin and Ireland versus the U.S. because he's traveled a lot. He worked in the U.S. He worked in the U.K. He worked in Mozambique. That the tension, right, the stress level just seems so much lower in a city, even like Dublin, which in European and Irish standards is
it's
like
a rough,
rough place.
Right.
Either standard.
Only place worse is Glasgow.
Right. There's only 40 murders in the entire country of Ireland a year, you know? And the one is the fact that, this is one of the issues I'm kind of obsessed about, but like public transportation, the movement of goods and people is so easy because of the
train.
Don't you see
train,
that in Amsterdam?
Bus, walking, bicycle. Like it's all so integrated
amazing.
And easy
it's an
and cheap.
Amazing thing that when I'm on a New York subway thinking about in this country how our forefathers, our grandparents got that done. Politically, from a structural building tunnels underneath of this city, that we could do that 150 years ago. We could never do that. You'd never get a buy-in on that. And that's why when I was in Cologne last month, I mean, Cologne got bombed. You know, I mean, it's Germany, right? Everything's sort of built after 1940. The one thing they did was... They have an incredible rail system. Like, I looked up at it, I'm like, Cologne's not that big a place. It's like a Baltimore kind of 1
but
million.
The rail is one thing, because I only rented a bike. I didn't drive anywhere, right? So I was on a bus or train or a bike. I mean, I biked from Waterford to Cork and did the Frederick Douglass walking trail in Cork. There's an abolitionist walking
Cork's
trail.
Cork's like a long
really?
Way.
Cork. It's a long way.
There's a
Cork's
Frederick
a
Douglass trail in Cork?
Yeah, Frederick Douglass. After his book was published, his life was in danger, right? They suggested he go to the UK, in Massachusetts.
Wow.
And he goes to Dublin. He's so popular in Irish because the Irish are fighting for independence
sure.
as well, right? They're subjugated by the British. He spends like 40 days in Ireland, and there's a Frederick Douglass abolitionist walking trail in Cork about where he gave all the speeches and his experience there. But yes, I was...
True history. I thought you're the history teacher here. Why is he teaching history?
I mean, you try to learn something every day.
I had written about this for the magazine, but now I have pictures of the thing and a personal experience that hopefully I'll be writing about. But, you know, I just on a... Walking in a bike, getting around, you know, a city like Dublin every day, everybody's outside, right? The number of streets that are closed. If it, in Baltimore, it would... The comparability... If all of Fells Point, all of Federal Hill... All of Locust Point, all of Harbor East were closed to traffic. You'd begin to approach why these cities are so amazing that we visit, right? You'd begin to approach
that.
Well,
you go through Amsterdam, you walk in the street because there are no cars.
Well, that's right. There's no cars. That's the point, right?
I want a break. But
he's written about that. Yeah, we will take a quick break, then come back. Ron's written about that before. When we come back, I want to start with Ron answering this question. And then we'll talk a little bit, get an update on the Keith Davis murder trial. But Ron raises the question in the article, when he says, how has Baltimore fared in the two decades since the city first got a long, hard look at itself on HBO? Let's come back and start with that. How have we done in the two decades since then?
We're doing pretty well. We're at State Fair. I've had chicken and waffles. It's all brought to you by our friends at the Maryland Lottery. We're giving away some Show Me $10,000 scratch-offs. Also, our friends at Window Nation and our dear friends at Goodwill. I got my Goodwill truck back. I thought I lost my truck. My spring cleaning has gone well. We're sending the truck over to take it off to Goodwill. You can find Lisa Rusiniak this week out at Baltimore Positive as well. I am Nestor. We're with Ron Cassie from Baltimore Magazine. Don Moeller is here. He's not waving the Baltimore magazine. He's waving
Ron the real
Cassie.
Thing.
So we're going to talk some Wire. We're going to come back and continue on about all things Ireland and the 4th of July. I'm Nestor. We are WNST AM 1570. Stay with us. We're at State Fair.